Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
So, joining us today is Wayne Perry, right from the Massachusetts area where this happened. How are you doing today, Wayne?
I'm doing okay.
Okay. Now, let's I came across you on Facebook. So, tell us how you're involved in the case or how you got involved.
All right. Well, my sister happened to be one of the victims, but I'll tell you how that came about. This all happened back in 1988 in the summer, the spring and summer of 1988. Lady that was missing was, I think she was, a couple of them were reported missing. This one was reported, I believe, was in April of 1988. From April to September, a total of 11 women went missing. The first body, they actually realized that there was murders were being committed on July 3rd, 1988. The first body was found on the side of a highway, 140, in southeastern Massachusetts. And, you know, they just thought it was just, a regular murder, which I guess if you can call murder regular, but they had no idea what was about to start. And, it hit fast. I mean, in a matter of, at least 6 months, nine bodies, they just kept piling up on the highways. My mother's birthday happened to be in October 9th it was. My sister Debbie, her name was Deborah DeMello, it was a married name. She had never missed a birthday of my mother's ever. Whether either she came to the house or she would make a phone call or send a card, but she never missed it. Well, my mother's birthday came and went. My birthday, November 7th, came and went. And it was kind of strange, but on November 8th, I happened to be watching the news. And by this time, there was two bodies that had been found. So anyways, on November 8th, I'm watching them, and all of a sudden it breaks in that they had another body has been located on the 195 eastbound side of down in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. It was called the Reed Road exit. So I'm watching them, sitting, thinking to myself, man, another body. And then I'm watching them carry this body out. The woods were exactly, they were in a body bag. Most of the bodies that they found were skeletal because it was one of the hottest summers on record out here then. And all these women were murdered during the spring and summer, so there wasn't much left. But anyways, I'm watching them bring this black body bag up from the woods. It was just about dark time. Put it into a hearse. And didn't think up my body. I didn't think again, well, there's another one that's a finding. That's when they realized they had a serial killer because of the way they were being found all on the side of the highway. So go ahead.
When you say they were found by the side of the highway, so what was this serial killer doing to them? Was he like, pick them up somewhere, attack them, and then rape and kill them type thing?
Well, what it was is most of the women had either a drug problem or some were doing prostitution. And I'm really touchy on this part because my sister had issues, and all those women did. But if you were living out here that time, the media made it like it was okay that these women were dead because they weren't high class, you know, rich people with a fancy last name. So, I mean, for 30 years now, I have been arguing with people over, I just don't understand. They, instead of just calling me, Deborah DeMello died or Sandra Botello died, was murdered. It's that prostitute or that drug addict. I don't understand why they have to label someone who's been murdered because of what they did in the past. They weren't hurt nobody. You know, they had addiction problems, and some of them to feed that addiction, they went into prostitution. And it's just the way that the general public even started it. They were looking at them as the prostitutes. One guy on a radio station made a remark that there was nothing but a pile of dead hookers. He put that on the air out here. And I found it out with a lot of people, my mother used to sit home and cry at night because of the things she would see on TV that they were calling her daughter and all the other women. What are you supposed to think? I mean, it's their fault they were murdered because they had a problem. Doesn't matter what kind of problem you have, you don't deserve to be murdered. But they made it like it was okay.
Yeah. No, it's a terrible thing. So when this started happening, this was in 88, I believe. What was the atmosphere then around the city? Like when it started, when they started finding girls, was the city panicked or did they just ignore?
Well, at first, like I said, they just thought it was just another murder, the first couple. But then when they found my sister, and I didn't know it was my sister, on November 8th, that's when one of the detectives from the New Bedford Police Department started putting two and two together and started believing that they had a serial killer, an active serial killer in the area. And the FBI was called in. There was a bunch of different law enforcement agencies that were involved. None of them got along. They all fought. They withheld information from each other. This is the way this whole thing went from the beginning. But most of them would hang around this section of New Bedford called the Weld Square area. It was where there was bars, and that's where, a guy, if he was looking for a prostitute or whatever, that was the section to go. Everybody has that area in, a city or a town that they know where to go if that's what they want. You can buy drugs there or whatever. And there was a lot of, undercover detectives that used to, work the area, and they started realizing that these different girls that used to see every night all of a sudden weren't there anymore. And a couple of them, like I said, they were reported missing, one by her boyfriend. One of the victims' name was Nancy Piver. Her boyfriend, I guess, had a real bad police record, and he actually went into the police department in New Bedford and reported her missing. And they were so shocked because he had never gone into a police department without handcuffs ever in his life. And they actually, at the time, had him as a suspect because of his past. I guess he had a violent past, but. Anyways, like I said, it was an area in New Bedford. It was just a low-scale area where the girls started missing from. And as I was saying about my sister, she didn't get a hold of my mother or any of us about her birthday, my birthday fast. So I started thinking, and my wife mentioned to me, I had a feeling all along that maybe my sister might have been one of them, and I just didn't want to believe it, so I put it to the side. Finally, one night, my wife said, Wayne, you got to call. So I called the Bristol County District Attorney's Office, which is the county the district attorney that's in charge of that area down there in New Bedford. And they put me to a special state police unit that was investigating it. And I talked to a lieutenant at the time. His name was Jose Gonzalez. I got to know him as Josie. And his partner, Mary Ann Dill, they were two pretty high-ranking state police troopers there. But anyways, they asked me a bunch of questions, and I answered everything I could think of. And just before he was about to hang up, he says, "Oh, Wayne, hold it for a minute." He goes, did your sister ever have any broken bones? And I says, I started thinking about it. I says, no, she didn't have, never had anything like that. And then we were about to hang up again. I go, whoa, wait a minute. I had remembered one time when she was in a women's jail in Massachusetts, Framingham, Massachusetts, that she had had a fight with somebody in there and she had broken her wrist. So I said to him, I said, now that I do remember, she did have a broken wrist. And right down there, his voice changed. He goes, oh, she did. And it was like a totally different tone. And I said, yeah, she's happened in a fight. And he says, do you know which one it was? And I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the right. He goes, the right, you say? I said, yeah, the right. And right then, he just wanted to get her off the phone. He goes, okay, Wayne. He says, well, thank you for calling. Well, you know, we'll look into the information you gave us, and we'll let you know what's going on. So I'm thinking, you know, okay, well, like I said, that was probably maybe around my birthday was the 7th, probably around the November 10th and November 11th. Well, the way that they notify you, I think they do it in every state, is if there is a murder victim, you know, they find out that it is a positive ID, they come to your house. Well, December 24th, 1988, Christmas Eve, I get a knock on the door. And I open the door, and it was Mary Ann Dill and Josie, the two state troopers that I had talked to on the phone. I knew right then and there that it was my sister, because, I mean, why would they be at my house on Christmas Eve? So I let him come in. We talked, and he told me that she was the body that was found on Reed Road on November 8th. I literally watched them recover my sister's body out of the woods that night on TV and didn't know it.
What was he doing to the victims? Was there anything unique about the killer's MO?
What was strange about it is all of them were found latches of nine that were found, yeah. They were all found right off of the highway or off of a highway exit ramp. My sister, and they believe he was raping them. They believe the way he killed them was by strangulation. They know for a fact some of them because they found them, I think a cord around one of them's, neck, which, like I said, was at the time was all skeleton. And some of them got scars around their neck, and you could see how they had, the way they could tell that they had been tightened. So was what they figured was the cause of death, strangulation. But he was playing games with the police because my sister's body was found on the eastbound ramp of the Reed Road exit on Route 195. Well, this girl, I was telling you, named Nancy Piper, her body was found before my sister's, but they didn't get an ID on her until after my sister's. But anyways, they found her body, Nancy Piper, on the westbound off-ramp of 195 Reed Road exit. And with Nancy was my sister's clothes, and Nancy's clothes were with my sister. They didn't know each other. He was, taking one victim's clothes and putting them with another one, just playing games with the cops. Nine of the bodies were found. Two of them have never been found to this day. The two that haven't been found, one of them, his father, was a New Bedford police officer. The other one was her uncle was a New Bedford police officer. And it's like he deliberately hid these bodies extra special so they wouldn't find them. I mean, that's what a lot of people think. I mean, he did that deliberately. So just to play games.
How do you think the law enforcement were treating this?
Well, let me put you this way, okay? I found this out years later. Okay, at the time, there was a district attorney. His name was Ronald Pina. Boy, that he could talk up a storm. He could play anybody, and he played all the families. He had us thinking that there was this guy, and it made sense at the time. There was a guy's name was Kenneth Pont. He was a lawyer in the city of New Bedford. He had a shady background. He had been known for doing drugs now and then. He would always take the cases that, what do you want to call it, low-life cases or whatever. I don't know how you want to describe it, but...
Yeah.
He was friends with Ron Pina at one time, and Ron Pina, which we, like I said, I found out years after, he had a celebrity girlfriend. Her name was Sheila Martinez. She was a TV news, news person on Channel 10 in Rhode Island at the time. They were both real bad into cocaine, the district attorney and her. And it come to find out that Kenneth Pont was supplying the drugs to them. Well, there was some kind of arguments that had happened over the, you know, the years that they were working with each other. And Ron Pina had a vendetta against him. He wanted to have him put in jail. He literally tried to frame him for the murders of both women. He had him indicted by the grand jury, which the charges were dropped eventually. And he totally just destroyed the guy's life. The guy was no angel. Far from it. The guy was a scumbag. He was a lawyer. He knew all the girls. Now, jumping back a little bit, Christmas of 1987 was the last time I seen my sister, okay? But she was in jail at the time. She was in jail at a Rhode Island women's prison, Rhode Island, I think it was in Providence, Rhode Island. But we went down to see her, and she had really cleaned up her act while she was in jail. She had gotten her GED. She just totally had a different attitude. And she was telling me and my mother and her daughter, Chandra, at the time was, I think, 16, 15 years old, how this lawyer had come in, and she never told us his name. And, you know, he wanted to help her. He was that kind of a guy. He liked to help women, stuff that, you know, had drug problems, stuff like that. And that he had a house down in Port Richey, Florida, that, you know, he was going to take her down and, you know, get her cleaned up and, you know, just try to get her back on her feet. Well, come to find out then, this lawyer, I mean, she never told us his name, but I mean, then after the murders took place, you know, this, all of a sudden this lawyer pops up, Kenneth Pont, who happened to know just about all the women who were murdered. So the cops were using that as a, you know, as, ammo against the guy, saying that, he did have a reason to kill him. He knew them, and that he was selling drugs and he was beating them and raping them and stuff like that. But, like I said, the Ron Pina, I mean, he wasted months and months of investigative time just on Kenneth Pont. He wouldn't get it out of his mind. He knew it wasn't Kenneth Pont, but he wanted to get the guy put in jail because of some kind of bad drug deal that had gone down between him and, like I said, his celebrity girlfriend there and Ken Pont, you know, the three of them. So,
well. I was going to, but were the police in general supportive and really trying to find the person?
I don't believe so, no. There was some, the police did more fighting amongst each other than anything. The district attorney's office, Ron Pina, they all have a state police unit that's in there. They were arguing with each other. The Ron Pina didn't want the state police in there, and he didn't want this and he didn't want that because of the reason why that we know now is because of what he was doing. The police departments would not share information because at one of the bodies was found in a different county, Plymouth County in Massachusetts, a little town called Marion. Actually, she was the last body, the last one that they had found. She was found in May of 1989 for the last body was found. And it just so happened, it was in the county next to Bristol County. So right then and there, now you've got two counties, two district attorneys, totally two different state police departments dealing with this. Just total chaos. So the small each town that they found the body in, like they found my sister in Dartmouth police were involved. They found bodies in Freetown police were involved. There were so many police departments, and all of them were arguing and fighting and not sharing anything they knew. They would not share with each other. So, you know, I mean, whatever they had, if you put it all together, maybe something could have been done. Maybe it could have been solved. But you know, in my opinion, I call it, they were all having major ego trips at the time, and because of that, everybody would say this, that the murderer just basically just walked out of town. He just walked away. So, some people think that the guy went to Connecticut next after that, because right when these murders stopped in Massachusetts. They started down in an area in Connecticut. They called them the Route 8 murders. Now the highway, and it was killing girls down there. But we don't know if it was connected, but a lot of people think it was.
Were there any other suspects?
Oh yeah. There was numerous. This case, the Bedford Highway serial killings, is the second biggest murder investigation in Massachusetts history, second only to the Boston Strangler back in the 60s. Okay? And it was handled, the police departments that were handling it had never, ever had any experience in serial killers, knew nothing about them. So basically, they were like a on-training type thing. There was numerous suspects. Some of them stood out more than others. There was a Anthony DeGrazia, they called him Tony. The thing about him is, I mean, I don't know if you know much, I'm sure you do, but serial killers don't, they'll either kill everyone that they get, that they go after, or they won't kill them. Well, he was being charged at one time for the rape and attempted rape of like, I think it was 17 different women in New Bedford. So they were trying to make it sound, they wanted to get this guy too. They were looking for anybody they could because people were starting to get mad. Some of the public was really stood by us, a lot of them did. But they were trying, it seemed to me, like just to get anybody so they could, you know, just make everybody happy. Oh, we caught him, whether it was the right guy or not. But they were trying to make this Tony DeGrazia look like that when he started, he went out there and murdered them, but now he was only raping them. Serial killers don't work like that. They don't leave nobody to, identify them. Like I said, they either murder you or they don't. It's one or the other. But they don't rape half their victims and then murder the rest. And even some of the state police that I was friends with agreed with me on that. But the district attorney's office, you know, they were just trying to, like I said, push whatever they could. Because that Ron Pina had made a total disgrace out of the Bristol County one. And then he lost an election, a new district attorney came in, and, oh, he made it like, we're going to really gung-ho, we're going to get this case settled. He did nothing. I can literally count on one hand, and this is no lie, the amount of times that district attorney office has called my family with any information. They just, there's no information given to any of us. Another guy named, another suspect, James Baker. He was another one that knew a lot of the girls from Wells Square. He used to let them stay at his house. He was a over-the-road truck driver. Now, a lot of the women, some of the women that had been attempted to, somebody had attempted to abduct them, and they were supposedly seen in a tractor trailer, you know, the tractor part of it. And so they started believing that maybe it was a long-haul truck, you know, going up and down the East Coast. Well, this James Baker just happened to be one, and he knew all the girls, and he also had been charged with rape and assault on some of the women, too. Because, like I said, he had them staying at his house. He was indicted to the grand jury as a witness. And there was a lot of other people that witnessed, too, but they were so, a lot of them had drug problems that they just, I don't know how they described it, but they just said, the way they told the stories just wouldn't hold up. You know, they just weren't, you know, one minute they'd have, they tell you one story, then 10 minutes later it would change. So they couldn't use them. But the James Baker guy, they interviewed him for over 4 hours. He supposedly, they gave him a polygraph test, which they say he passed, but polygraph tests can be beat. Many people have done it. Eventually, after he got cleared, and there was no investigation on him at all. Just a very little bit, you know, 3 or 4 hours, like I said, in the grand jury. And that was it. Eventually, the guy left the state and moved to Titusville, Florida. When he moved down there, all of a sudden, I think 3 to 4 months after he moved down there, a serial killer became active in the area, killing women. And this guy, like I said, just left Massachusetts where they have 11 dead, and now he's down there, and women are turning up dead now. Nothing was ever done about him down there. He ended up dying in 2007, I believe, of cancer. But there's a lot of people think that he had a lot to do with it. I've had people, like, you know, I have my website. I have people, sometimes I get calls from people I don't even know, and they start talking about information and places and things, and they know what they're talking about. Because, you know, I've had 30 years to do my homework, so I know just about every place there is down there, what to talk about, who the people are. And one of them who called me about 3 or 4 months ago, was dead set that it was James Baker. I guess she used to, when she was younger, she used to babysit for his kids. She knew him personally. And he was a, I guess she said he was a weird type guy. Her stepfather was friends with this James Baker, and her stepfather used to beat her mother. And this Baker guy would come over there and watch while he would beat her mother, and they would both just laugh at it. And he made a statement one time that he knew who the killer was, but he wouldn't say. The only thing he did say was that the killer had a girlfriend or a wife, and her nickname was Honda. They called her Honda. I'm thinking, well, maybe because she had a Honda car of some sort. I don't know. But the name that he had originally given, they never mentioned it, so she never got that. But she has all kinds of information. I have a friend of mine who works for state police, and she tells me a lot of things that they don't know that she tells me she's not supposed to. So I got in touch with her, and I had her call this girl, and she took down a bunch of information, and they've been working on that too. I mean, the James Baker guy again, he's back in the light.
Wayne, I've got a beaten path question. It's a sort of a long question. The New Bedford Highway murders. There's a couple of girls missing from those murders, or supposedly murdered, and along the same time, I mean, almost parallel with the New Bedford Highway murders was the Colonial Parkway murders. Now, in the Colonial Parkway murders, there's a couple missing as well from that, and there's some supposition with the Colonial Parkway murders that maybe there was more than one person involved. Has there been any look into whether maybe there was a connection between the two of those separate, there's 8 hours drive time, obviously, between.
Yeah.
But has there been any, like, you know, hey, is there a connection to any of this?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Well, I've heard of some connections for a few different serial murders. I've heard, I never heard that one. That there being any connection with that, but that's just like because, you know, I just might have missed it. I don't know. The only connections that I had ever heard that were possible was the, like I said, the one in Connecticut, which they called the Route 8 murder, serial murderer. There was one on Long Island, I believe, in New York, that they were trying to possibly put a connection to. And then there was another one out in Ohio. And they were basically, they were connecting with them because they were saying they were the same kind of women. They lived the same lifestyle. They were found in the same way and believed murdered in the same way. And they were all around the same time. Now, before these New Bedford Highway murders, 2 years prior to that, there were 5 women murdered out in New Bedford. I believe, and a lot of my friends do, that know what they're talking about, that these murders started 2 or 3 years prior to 88. I believe that those 5 women that were murdered before were victims of that serial killer. And there was 2 more that were murdered a few years after that people think that was victims of him too. So a lot of people think that there's 18 women this guy killed. That's how many I've counted. And, I mean, it's just, the way they happen, they're just so close and so identical to each other that it's almost like, how could they not be? But, you know, they just because to me, it's like, it's just a couple of years that span that went by with the murders. Well, it couldn't be him. Well, yeah, it would be because some serial killers, they kill for 40 or more years. They'll kill for 2 or 3 years, and they start for a few years, and next thing you know, they're active again.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, there's variation. Some will kill for several years and then possibly never kill again. But I was looking over those two as I was looking at the New Bedford Highway cases. Mm-hmm. I remembered the Colonial Parkway, and I remembered there were a couple of people missing as well from that. And I thought, that's sort of weird, but things like that happen. But the more I thought about it, I thought, maybe, of course, there's, like I said, there's 8 hours drive time, so but that's not undoable at all. And it just, and with the fact that the Colonial Parkway, like I said, Colonial Parkway murders, there is some talk that maybe there was more than one killer involved in those.
Yeah,
I just wondered if maybe somebody had looked at that.
Yeah. Okay. What state is the Colonial Park murders in?
Those were in, Colonial Parkway. I'm trying to remember what state that was. Virginia. Okay. Yeah, Virginia.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, the first one I heard of, like I said, was Ohio. As far as killers, here's another thing that was going on down in New Bedford at the same time these murders were going on. There's a place in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. It's called the Bridgewater Institute for the Sexually Dangerous. What it holds in there is just basically scum, in my opinion, that shouldn't be allowed to walk the earth. Pedophiles, guys that have raped and murdered little kids. Anything to do with a sexual crime, violent or nonviolent, are in there. Well, at the time, this was an election year, too, 1988. It was when George Bush and Michael Dukakis from Massachusetts were running. He was running. He was the governor of Mass, and he was running for president. I don't know if you remember that back then.
Yeah.
And Michael Dukakis had started a furlough program. And when he started it, it was just, it was a type of furlough, that they were going to let, not violent criminals out. Some of these guys that were in that Bridgewater place were murderers. There was a sexual crime and murder resulted in that. Well, anyways, he was starting a furlough program, and there was supposed to be just, nonviolent criminals that were let out into the public and, basically a test to see if they could go back into the living with the general population again. Well, the people that were getting released were no angels. They were murderers. pedophiles, you name it. They were coming out of that sexual, the Bridgewater Institute there for the sexual dangerous. Well, three of them, one by the name of Ron Leftwich, Kenny Jr., and I can't think of the other one's name. Well, two of them were living in the Wells Square area, area of New Bedford at the time, where all these girls were missing from. They were rapists. One of them was actually a murderer. So it was nothing new to them, I mean, as far as, you know, being able to hunt down a certain type of person if that's what they were looking for. They were allowed to be free 6 days and six nights per week and had to return on Sunday nights just to check in. And no supervision, no daily phone calls. One day a week, you come back here on Sundays and check in. One of them owned a white pickup truck. There was a girl in New Bedford one night that had been abducted by a man in a white pickup truck. He tried to handcuff her to the stick shift in the truck. Somehow she got away. I guess he had beat the hell out of her first. She got away and hysterically went to one of the police departments down there. When they interviewed her, she gave them a description of the guy. She gave him the plate number of the truck and some other information. The plate number turned out to be from registered to one of those guys. I think it was to Kenny Jr. The description she gave was like a photograph of him, the way she described it, and described the truck and everything about the handcuffs. They totally ignored her. Nothing was ever done. She left the state because she was scared for her life. She was, that they were, you know, that she had gone to the police department. They were going to find us out. And, you know, she thought that she was going to be killed. She left the state. To this day, there's only a couple of people. Well, I know a lady who knows where she lives now. I guess it's down south, she was telling me. But it was things like this that, you know, information that was being brought in but was just being totally overlooked. Now, why? What's the reason for that? Something like that, you overlook a girl coming in that's been beat, they beat the hell out of her. She just escaped from a guy trying to abduct her in a white pickup truck that a lot of the women in the area were complaining about. Trying to handcuff her. She gives the plate number, the registration number. She identifies the guy, and she's, you know, basically, you know, tells him everything they need to know with the truck, and they do nothing about it. I can't understand why that was done. I mean, I don't understand it. The names that I told you that came out of that institute, they were never investigated. They were never looked into. They never stepped a foot into a police department the whole time. When they left, the furlough program ended because of, I think it was because of, obviously, you know, it wasn't being run right. But when the furlough program ended, all those guys were made to go back into jail. The murder stopped. It's just, you know, we don't know for sure if it was them, but the murder stopped when they left, just like they did when Baker left. But, like I said, nothing ever came, you know, about it. They just ignored it. They ignored a lot of things. And I think, I mean, I don't know, me and a lot of the people now, the people that, you know, are really against what had happened, they believe, for some reason, we don't know why, that this case, they don't want to solve it. And it may sound strange and, you know, crazy, but they don't want to solve it. And I don't understand. They have six pallets with evidence stacked up 5 to 6 feet on each one, sitting in the basement of a state police facility. I think it's over in Middleborough, Massachusetts. And you're telling me that somewhere in there, the answer's not in there? 6 pallets, 6 feet tall, filled with evidence.
Well, why do you think that they wouldn't want to solve it? Like, do you think that it's because there's no money in it, or do you think that they know the suspect and it might be someone they know that they don't want to convict?
That's been said, too. A lot of people also were putting, at the time, a New Bedford narcotics undercover narc, who supposedly they were saying was involved in these murders. This guy has died since. But nobody ever heard anything about him. There's people out there that will swear that he was involved in these murders. But you never heard about him because he was a cop. And those two other women that you would ask me questions about a while ago, they were related to cops, though. I think I mentioned that before, but they were never found. They were hidden extra special, it seemed like. A lot of people think it was political. It was someone trying to destroy the Dukakis administration at the time. These crazy things have come up, but you don't know what to think anymore because there's no information ever given to us. None. Well, I've called the district attorney's office down in Bristol County. Okay, well, he's busy right now. I'll have him call you back. That was 10 years ago. I'm still waiting for that call. My sister's daughter, Chandra, has called. She called it three or four days in a row. He's busy. He's got a very important case. He will get back. I think that was 15, 20 years ago. She's still waiting.
Yeah.
I lost it on him about a month ago. I just totally went crazy on the phone. But they don't care. They just ignore you and they just push you to the side.
Tell the listeners about your website and what you've got on it and kind of what the purpose of it is.
Well, the purpose of it is some of the families their loved ones were one of the victims. Some of them just can't get over what had happened, which I can understand that. But you've got to get by it to a certain point, because if you don't, it's just going to eat you alive and nothing's going to get done, because Lamar enforcement's doing nothing. So I saw nothing being done with any of this. 15 years go by, 20 years go by, and then just recently the 30 years go by, and, some of the TV stations calling me and talking to me and stuff. And before this had happened, it was like, I think about 2 years ago, I started just thinking to myself, these girls are going to be forgotten. Their names right now are sitting in a basement somewhere, collecting dust, and each and every day that goes by, it just totally... It's just getting further and further out of the minds of the people in the area. Some of the people are dead. Most of the victims' parents are all gone. My sister would have been 65 years old today. I mean, on August 16th. She was 34 when she was murdered. So a lot of people have died, but I'm just thinking, eventually this is just going to be a case that's just going to be in the record books or whatever you want to call it. People say, oh, yeah, I heard about that years ago, and that's it. It's over. Well, I don't want my sister's name to end like that. And I don't want those other girls' names to end like that. A lot of people say that I'm their voice now, and that's the way I feel. I speak for them. Because nobody else will. I don't know why. It's like, are they afraid? I don't know. I ain't afraid of the police department. I ain't afraid of district attorneys. They're not trying to sound like I'm a badass. But I'm not. I tell them, and I say it the way I see it, the way I feel it. If you don't like it, that's your tough luck. I'm going to speak my piece and what I feel. Because there's something definitely going on in this state of Massachusetts, in that county of Bristol County. And there's some sort of a cover-up, there's corruption, something's going on. 11 women don't get murdered, and nobody knows nothing for 30 years. It don't happen. I mean, it does. I can see, on a single murder or a couple, on 11 women, there's too many people that know. Somebody knows out there. Somebody knows what happened. And I don't know if they're just afraid to tell. I don't know what the story is.
How does something like this affect your family and your life? How did it affect you guys, your whole family from then till now? Like, does it ever get better or easier?
No, it will never get better. All of our lives changed then. On November 8th, 1988, my life totally changed for good. My whole family did. And it's never going to be the same. It never will be. And it just makes it harder when all you're getting is the feeling that nobody cares no more. As far as nobody cares, the people that can do something about it, they just don't give a damn. And I've said all along, if these girls were the daughters of lawyers or judges or booty actors, this case would have been solved. And if it wasn't solved by now, you can bet your rear they'd be out there every single day, an army of them, until they did solve it. But these girls, their lifestyle wasn't the type, in their eyes, I guess, that deserved to be investigated and to get justice, the families get closure. We got nothing. We got nothing, It's just, we got ripped off is what we all got. And it's nobody cares.
You were mentioning one of the girls that was killed was a police officer's daughter?
Two of them were. One of them was a police officer's daughter, The other one's uncle was a police officer. Those are the two that have never been found. There's just some weird things that happened. Weird things. Here's another one that's very interesting. I believe it was maybe a couple months after the first body was found, a letter was sent to the district attorney's office in Bristol County. And it was from an unknown person, and they said that they had been on this road, and it was Route 88, and they had seen a vehicle parked on the side of the road, and they believed that they had saw the guy carrying a body and bringing it into the woods. And they wouldn't say who they were, but they did say, if you do find a body in that area, then this confirms my story, and I will come forward. Well, sure as hell, about a month later, they found the body exactly where she said. It turned out to be a lady. They didn't tell us who she was, but we did find out it was a female. They found the body exactly where she said they would find one. But that was the last you ever heard of that. She never heard anything more. You know? She had got a description of the car. I don't believe she got a registration number, but there's a lot more information that was told. I mean, you know, that they didn't tell the general public. Nothing was ever done about it. This lady saw who the killer was. She saw them. She saw the guy. There was only one that she could see, I guess. I don't know if there was others. She didn't see any others that, you know, that she mentioned that I know of. She might have, but, you know, like I said, they didn't tell others. But she saw this guy carrying a body out of the car and bringing it in some woods. And they found the body right where she said.
So, Neil,
why wasn't anything
done? The two girls that were relatives of the cops and their bodies were never found. How did police ascribe this to this serial killer? Like, what made them think it was this if they've never found the bodies?
That's what I used to wonder, but I guess they can't be 100% sure. But the two girls that have never been found, exact same lifestyles, hung in the exact same areas, disappeared when all this was happening from that area, and, you know, never heard from again. So, I mean, what's the chances of them being killed by... I mean, there's always a possibility that it was somebody else, but I believe it also that it was the serial killer that killed them, too. I believe he knew who they were. He knew the cops. A lot of people think that this guy is from the area. He knows the ins and outs. He's someone that could sit in there to stand right next to you. You know, with a bunch of cops, and you would know it was him. That's what it was. And that's why this narcotic agent at one time came up as being involved in knowing who did it and was involved in doing it. So, I mean, there's so many different stories. I feel strong in myself on Baker and the three guys from the Bridgewater Institute there. I have a friend of mine. He's an investigative journalist, and he called me up. I didn't even know this guy. Well, 10 years ago, he called me up out of the blue. Never met him. Didn't know who the hell he was. And he had been looking into this case, you know, from I guess since maybe a month after, you know, it started. About a month after he actually realized that it was a serial killer, he got right into it. Started doing all kinds of his own investigation. Came up with numerous things. There's things about from the church those people that I told you from that sexual institute, the church was bringing them to stay in places down in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. One of them was a registered I forget what class it was, pedophile with children. They brought him into a church, and he was living in the rectory right next to the daycare center. This guy ended up murdering the priest that was there. Eventually, he's in jail now for murdering that priest. And this was the church town that was involved. But they sent him up, they sent those three guys up down in New Bedford with that apartment they were living in. The church did this. They had the priest name.
Wayne, did they collect, were they able to collect any DNA evidence on these murders?
At the time, 1988, DNA was at its infancy. You know, I mean, it just had become a possible source of using for evidence. But like I said, these cops, none of them had any experience in anything like that. They didn't know nothing about serial killers. They knew nothing. I've been told that there was DNA, then I've been told there isn't DNA. Then I got told by my friend, who's, you know, I told you, you know, tells me a lot. She told me, she says, Wayne, she says, the DNA that they do have, okay, a lot of it was mishandled, and it was incorrectly packaged, which it was contaminated, so it's no good. But she said, what they do have, it would take a major, major breakthrough in technology, the DNA technology, to possibly use. So that tells me it ain't worth anything. I mean, she's saying a major breakthrough. Now, we have a lot of technology right now with DNA, and she's talking about another major breakthrough. So ain't going to happen in my lifetime.
Yeah, well, you know, on these victims, I'm assuming that they kept what clothing and items that were found. Have they not sent these items off or looked on these items for any trace evidence that you know of?
From what I understand, it was sent to the FBI crime lab. And the last time, actually, it was sent out again, from what I hear, back in 2008. But that was an election year for the district attorney. So this is over Sandy quite large, too. Every time there's a district attorney going to be reelected, we're opening up the New Bedford Highway serial killer's case again. They're always opening it up. 2 weeks after he's in office, sitting on his fat ass, pardon my English, you don't hear another word about it ever again until the next election. That's how it's gone. It's a game. It's a game to them. You know, we'll use that because they feel that that's political, value to them. We'll use that to tell them we're going to open the case again. You know, maybe we'll get people to vote for me and I'll get in office. Once I'm in there, well, tough luck for them, and they don't do nothing. Right now, they have one state trooper working. She's a female. That's the one who's my friend. Back in 88, they had 50, 60, 70 full-time detectives working this case, and they couldn't solve it then. How the hell do they expect one detective 30 years later to solve this case? I don't even know why they haven't been doing it. Maybe it's what they think that's going to shut us up, because it doesn't. I think it's totally ridiculous. They're making a fool out of themselves, sticking one person out there to do this.
Yeah.
She ain't going to do it. It would have to be an act of God for her to be able to, to solve this case. Someone would have to come to her and confess and have proof that he did do it. But that's the only way that it can be done now, they're telling me. Someone would actually have to come to them, confess, but then prove that he was the killer. How do you prove you're the killer?
Yeah.
So basically, they're telling me it's never going to be solved.
Okay. Give your website out to the listeners.
Yep. It's actually it's a Facebook group page. It's called, there's actually a book titled the same way, but it's just a one little difference in it. It's called Shallow Graves, and then there's a comma, and it's The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer. Now, there's also a book, like I said, written by a very good friend of mine, and the book is excellent. It's titled the same. It's Shallow Graves with a semicolon, The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer. The author is Maureen Boyle. Tells you everything.
Yeah, we're going to have her on the show next week.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Go through the book as well. To get as much exposure as possible on this, and see what happens.
I feel if it gets out there, hopefully someone will see this and say, "Hey, I know that. I know who did that. Or I know this. Anything. It only takes the smallest amount of information to turn this whole thing around." You know,
exactly.
I don't have any confidence in it anymore. I have no respect for them. The only thing I have left is hope. That's it.
Yeah. Well, our guest has been Wayne Perry, and we've been talking about a new crime that we're just getting into now. And like I said, Maureen Boyle will be here next week talking about her book, Shallow Grave. Well, Wayne, thank you very much for taking this time to talk to us.
I just want to say one more thing, too, okay?
Yeah.
Since 1980, there are 240,000 unsolved homicides in this country. 240,000. That's since 1980. I don't even know what the numbers are before that. Something that's got to be done as far as the law is being changed in this country. After a certain amount of time, the victim's family should have the rights to be able to look into the records that they have obtained and evidence. Because as long as that sits on the shelf and they do nothing, How can it be solved if it's not being worked on? The families could hire their own private investigators to look on it 100%, just that, you know, that case, and on their own time. But as long as there's the murder investigation open to this country, nobody sees that. Nobody sees that information. Nobody can touch it. Nothing can be done. So as long as the police want to sit there and do nothing about it, well, you'll get your answer the same way. You'll never get one. I don't believe, like I said, that I will ever get the answer that I'm looking for. I hope I do. I just don't have that confidence anymore. I used to. I just know too much now. But 240,000 homicides that are unsolved, cold cases. So think about that. You know, something has got to be done. And, you know, I mean, that's another thing I'm trying to get going. I'm trying to get you to group being together, because you're not going to do it as one. It's going to take a bunch of us. But it's the only way things are going to change.
Well, thank you, Wayne.
Well, I appreciate you guys giving me the time, because, like I said, I just want to get it out there. Hopefully somebody will know something someday, and maybe it will be solved.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, all shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.